Radio, and here we go, another episode of We Talk Music on the Air and in Your Ear. Once again, I am Mata, joined by, well, you know him, he's the king of the casters there, Mr. Brett Podcast. And Brett, we're done with you. You don't have to tell us anything else about yourself. You have to get right to the guest.
That's right. Well, we won ourselves some great beats. We decided to go back to the drums. So we decided to go and have a visit with Marcus Boltz, who is the drummer for Corporate Control. And the new album is Whatever It Takes. And I got to tell you, Marcus, happy to have you on because I'm really enjoying this album. And I think the more that I listen to it, the more that I enjoy it.
Oh, wow. Thanks. Thanks. And thanks for having me on your podcast.
Well, it's honestly, it's a great honor, and so let's talk about Whatever It Takes and how you put it together. Because, I mean, A, besides the fact that there's you, you got some amazing people. I mean, you got Paul Sabu and Barry Sparks on here. I mean, so that's a hell of a band.
It is. And there's also, I also want to mention there's Michael Landau, legendary guitar player, worked with Miles Davis, Joni Mitchell, Seal. You name it. I think he's one of the most recorded guitar players, along with Steve Lukather. He's playing guitars on two tracks. And there's my good friend Martin Motnick, who's now bassist for German legendary metal band Accept. He's also on two tracks on the album.
Wow. So yeah, tell us how it came about. How did you decide? Because you decided to put this album together, didn't you?
Right. Yeah. Well, it didn't start. I wasn't too serious in the beginning. You know, my daily routine is I make music for trailer, for computer games, TV music, stuff like this. And it's funny, you know, I grew up with rock, and funnily enough, I never played a whole lot rock music, even though it's my DNA. You know, I kind of drifted away into pop and funk stuff, which was great, you know, no complaints. But and I thought it was time to finally make a rock album. And actually, I started with a cover version. You know, I wasn't too serious about getting an album together. All I knew is that I wanted to work with awesome people. And so I got in contact with Paul, and we did the first song. And when he sent me back the lead vocal stems, I was like, holy shit, man, this sounds great. You know, it came together so naturally. It felt right. And I was like, it'd be dumb to just churn out some cover versions. You know, let's totally go for it. And that's what I did.
So then tell us about the songwriting and how that kind of was put together.
First couple of songs I had already written with, I'm working with my songwriting partner, Sandra Bellogi. She's an awesome, awesome songwriter. And we're working together since years. And we had a few songs that we thought were really good, but we never placed them, or we never, you know, they were just sleeping on our hard drive. And it was pop songs. We just did a layout, you know, programmed VST stuff and her vocals on it. And I was like, man, let's take those songs. It should work. You know, like the bands I grew up with, especially Def Leppard. I mean, it's great pop songs, you know, they're just a little heavier and edgier and that stuff. Or Whitesnake or Kiss, you know, it's all about the songs. And so we started, or I started rearranging those songs, a bunch of them, and everything went, it turned out really great. And Paul Sabu also put a lot of ideas into it and kind of reshaped some stuff we sent him. You know, we're exchanging ideas back and forth. And that's how it started. And during that process, we also started writing new material.
And so then you produced the album too, as well, I guess, and like
Right.
Paul co-produced it. Like, so obvious, I mean, my guess is that you were all in your separate studios and then you just kind of took it in, did you?
Right. Right. I tracked the drums in a remote studio in Munich, and the rest was, like sending back and forth files. I'm in Germany. Paul's in, I think he moved to Mexico actually, and Barry is in the United States. So there was just no way that we would all get together in a room and track that stuff together.
Did you know Paul and Barry before before you started recording the album?
Not personally. I worked with in the past. I worked with a producer. His name is Chris Lausmann, and he did. He produced the Voices of Rock albums, which also feature. The idea was they wrote songs. They had the same musicians on each song, but they had a different singer on each song, and they pick really, like there's Jolin Turner, there's Tony Martin of Black Sabbath, really great people there. And Paul Sabo is also on one of the songs. And I mean, of course it's a matter of personal taste, but to my ears, man, Paul just rocked up. He was my favorite singer on that project. So I contacted him and said, "Hey, listen, I used to work with Chris, and I love what you did on his production. Would you be up to working with me?" And that's how we started. And Barry Sparks, I didn't know him. I started. That's why Martin Motnik is on a few tracks on bass. And Paul actually brought in Barry later, which was fine with me. Like I'm working on and off with Martin. It's never a big deal. And I'm always open to working with new people. And man, Barry is like, it's awesome. It's just awesome. So no complaints at all.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question. I mean, like I said, the talent level on the album is super awesome. Now, I mean, one of the things in the press release, it says that you recorded with no less than 20 mics for your
Right,
drums, and I'm like,
right.
that seems excessive. But I guess you're a drummer and a professional in the business, so like, tell me about that process a little bit.
Well, there was a session before the corporate control session. I went into the studio to record my drums in order to sell them as a sample library. So that's why I chose to mic this stuff excessively, so that you would have real good access to each component. Like it's like, okay, just a bunch of overheads won't do it. I need cymbal mics, we need room mics, tons of them. And actually, one of the cover songs I already tracked during that session. And when I decided to make a whole album, I was like, okay, I have to have a similar, if not, or as close as a drum sound from the previous session, so I could use all that stuff on the album, right? So it sounds organic, which didn't happen because I tossed the cover version, so it didn't matter in the end, but that was the idea at least.
What does it take then, I guess, to kind of create the drums, and like, do you take just a basic beat and then do you just build off of
It's whatever it takes, Brett. Don't you get
that? Yeah, whatever it takes,
it?
exactly.
Right. You mean specifically for corporate control, I guess.
Corporate control, but yeah, and then just even
Yeah.
beyond that.
Well, there was usually I would start. I would start an arrangement, and I would just use a loop for example, right? I would just use a shaker or something, and then build the drums during the playing. I would go in the studio, or first I would go in the rehearsal space and check out what feels right. But this time I actually programmed the drums first, and really try to have a fresh perspective. You know, like the thing is, if you're a musician and you pick up your instrument, there's one curse. You know, you kind of always you do what you do, right? There's some. I mean, of course, if you play with other people, it's a different story. But if you just sit down on the instrument, like you're kind of, I don't know, imprisoned by yourself, so to speak. So my idea was to program the drums first and create them more from a composer's perspective. You know, I have a lot of colleagues who produce music, who are composers, and they do amazing stuff with rhythm and drums, and they don't play the instrument. So I was like, man, maybe it's a good idea to do it another way this time and really kind of compose it first, program it first, and then actually go into the studio and then play that stuff and replace the VST drums with the real drums.
Is it hard to, like, not overdrum on songs? I mean, I think we've talked to a lot of guitarists, and I think there can be certainly like a desire to like overplay on the songs, but I mean you need to serve the song for the most part. So you know, like, is there that temptation to be like, oh, I'm gonna add a fill here or you know, a little flourish here?
Actually, not. I'm believe it or not, I'm the opposite. I'm like, people ask me to play more. You know, like I don't know how it came about. I think it's probably because I grew up listening to stuff that was pretty straight ahead, like CC Top, for example. You know, the drums are really straight, no nonsense, you know, 2 and 4 on the snare. And I don't know, I guess that influenced me a lot. I've never been very flashy on the drums.
What was it then that got you into playing the drums? Like, how old were you when you started?
I was 14, and I was already listening to rock music. And then I saw Tommy Lee on MTV, you know, spinning in this drum set. And then I went to my parents and said, I need a drum set. And that's how it started. It's Tommy Lee got me into drumming, definitely.
Makes sense. I mean, I think that he's one of those drummers that really can be influential, just you know, more so in the look more than anything. I mean, talk about making a drum image super cool.
Right. But he delivered. I mean, it's not that he just looked cool, you know. It's like, I mean, the drumming behind it is, he's an awesome rock drummer, man.
So that's an interesting thought. Like, who are the most awesome rock drummers for you?
Tommy Aldridge, definitely. Yeah, I think nothing comes close to him in terms of technical abilities. And he's one of those drummers, he can really go nuts, but somehow not overplay it. I know it sounds weird, but it's how I kind of see it. Cozy Powell was influential to me. It's great. Strumming on Rainbow Rising was something that really impressed me when I was young. Bill Ward, Sabbath was huge to me when I grew up. And
No, I was just gonna say, like, now after, you know, after you started drumming, like, at what point did you kind of decide that drumming was, this is my career, I'm going to become a drummer professionally?
I think I was serious from the beginning. It's like, I don't know, you know, when I was 14, I was trouble, you know. I was bad in school. I was a trouble kid, and you know, for some reason, or let's put it that way, the condition, or my parents would buy me a drum set and pay lessons if I was serious, you know, if I would practice and go get a right education. And there I went, and my drum teacher, I was progressing well, and you know, like, think of it, you know, you're 14, and then there's an adult who's telling you, yeah, man, you're doing a good job. You know, usually you hear like, yeah, you suck, you're a failure, you know, and that does something, you know, and it was uplifting and motivational. I suddenly had something I wouldn't totally suck at. So yeah, I was like, I didn't think of it so much as a career. I just thought, I don't want to do anything else, you know.
Because it's always so interesting, because I think, like, we see a lot of you know, people that join bands young, and then that's kind of their focus. But I mean, for you, it seems like your focus has been, you know, in winding up in music production and putting your music into other productions and stuff like that. So how does one get into that?
By accident. It was, I don't know, about 12 years ago, I did a solo album, which wasn't so much an album, or let's put it that way. There wasn't an artistic intent behind it. It was more like, you know, I came back from, I studied drums at the LA Music Academy, and I was called for recording sessions, you know. I mean, it was a dream come true for me, you know. I played on jingles, and I played with some well-known acts in Germany, and life was good. You know, we played support. I was in a band that was a support band for Anastasia, for example, you know, played huge festivals. And I did this album mainly to hand it to producers to hire me as a studio drummer, actually. That was the main idea. And a few tracks, there were a few instrumentals on it, some funky stuff. And somebody said, like, man, you should offer this to somebody. It's like, it's good score or good synth music stuff. And he helped me, you know, he sent it to a publisher, and they used some of that stuff. And suddenly that stuff was on television, and I said, whoa, wow, holy shit. And ever since, they kept asking for more music. And I was suddenly in this, you know, suddenly I had this second career going. And for a few years, I was running it parallel, and I thought I could continue so for forever. But it came to a point where I had to make a decision to either go fully into the production thing or fully into that live music thing. And I guess my survival instincts had something to do with it, choosing the production career.
That was the Transatlantic Funk Unit. Is that the,
right,
the album?
Right.
Yeah, we listened to that and really enjoyed it too. I think that's one of the best names I've ever heard. I don't know how you came up with that, but Transatlantic Funk Unit. That's awesome.
Yeah, it sounds so not commercial and not sellable and record company unfriendly, right?
But at the same time, I mean, like absolutely, like Martin said, I mean, we both really enjoyed the album. I do think that it's fun, and it also shows a lot of diversity in your playing, as I'm sure you wanted. But I think for me, it spoke to me because it's just like so many of the songs, and like funk is just something that I know we both really enjoy. So it's hard not to get into an album like that.
Cool, thanks.
So then, was that, like, when you recorded that, how did that work? Did you just kind of, you know, put all the songs together? I mean, obviously there's covers on there and that kind of thing. So, like, and then a bunch of different musicians, like, did you just find those from people around you at the time?
Right. As you mentioned, there's some cover versions, which also I picked I didn't pick them necessarily because I thought they needed a cover version. You know, like there's Message in a Bottle on there by the Police. And I mean, the world doesn't need a cover version of Message in a Bottle. But I did it because, as I said, you know, it was like a promotion thing for me as a drummer. It's like I would hand it to you as a producer who would hire me as a drummer and say, hey, look, I can play that. And that's some crazy drumming stuff on. I mean, Police is crazy mm-hmm. in terms of drums. And so I put together a couple of cover versions that I thought would represent my playing well. It wasn't so much about the songs. It was really like, it's like a drummer's business card, so to speak. Then we put on a few own songs. I thought since we're at it, we could record some of our songs and then offer them to other artists later. And then there's those small instrumentals that ended up as synth music.
Yeah, because there's some beautiful like fretless bass work on there. I really, like, as I'm listening, it's just like, ooh, that's really good. Now, is there ever been like kind of a desire in your mind to kind of bring back the band and do something else with it? Or is it kind of, it served its purpose and you're done with it now?
The later. It wasn't really a band. It's like, it was like a studio project. It doesn't feel anything like Corporate Control, you know, like, I mean, even though I'm kind of the architect of Corporate Control, it became a band. It wasn't even planned. It just, you know, like the chemistry, I mean, working with Paul was or is a blast, and Barry too. And we're like really like brothers almost by now. And this really is a band. And I think I like to think that you can hear it on the album, that it's, even though we haven't been in the same room at the same time, I think when I mixed it and I listened back to it, it's like, it feels like a band to me, which the Transatlantic Funk Unit wasn't. That was really like a gathering of guest musicians, so to speak.
How much do you talk to Paul and Barry now? I mean, that the album's done. Like, do you keep in touch on a regular basis? Do you kind of, are you making plans for things like a potential live shows or second album, that kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm talking to Paul a lot. A lot of it is business because, like, you know, the truth is, like, when you're done with an album, that's when the work starts. You know, there's you're not done. It's like you get into another phase of work. And, like, we had to do some radio IDs and stuff like this. And but I'm also talking to Paul about ideas and or like about another album, and we all really want to do one. We have two or three songs that we think are strong enough to put on an album, and we're up to writing new stuff, most definitely.
What do you do, I guess, as a new band to try to cut through and actually, you know, be heard by more people?
Well, I mean, most of that work is done by the record company. It's tough. It's tough to cut through. That's also why I'm really grateful to be on your podcast and for you guys promoting the album. You know, every little thing helps, definitely.
Yeah, I think it's like there's so much new music that gets released, so it is hard. But I mean, I'm sure glad that we were able to hear Corporate Control.
Yeah, I want to say my favorite track on it was Waiting for the Roar. Can you tell me about the inspiration for that one?
Waiting for the Roar was one of the songs that we had written already, like me and Sandra, my songwriting partner, and it was actually one with German lyrics. And we never kind of knew what to do with it. It's like if you record something with German lyrics, you're almost in that we call it Schlager kind of thing, you know, like it gets cheesy very, very easy. You have to be very careful with stuff like this. And besides that, I'm not too much of a big fan of music with German lyrics to start with. So, but I always had a heart for the hook line of the song. It's like, let's give it a try. And it turned out really cool. And this one is actually Michael Landau playing guitars. And when he sent me the guitar tracks, it's like, I was listening to single guitar tracks in my headphones for hours, you know, like on solo, like stuff that you wouldn't do if you're in your right mind. But it's like, I was like, oh man, those guitars are really, really beautiful. And yeah, and Paul also did like on every song, when I heard it compared to what we've done previously with the German lyrics, it sounded so much better. It was such an improvement, and I think it turned out pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, my favorite song is "What About Us," the end track. Like, just, I mean, there's several songs in here that I know that I've got in my head on a regular basis, but like every time like the album ends and it's just like "What About Us" comes up, and it's just like, oh yeah, now that's totally stuck in my head for a long time. How did that one come about?
What About Us? We also had written that one and rearranged it, but Paul did a lot on this one in terms. I really have to mention this. Paul did even though the backbone and the songwriting, if you will, was done by Sandra and myself. Paul had such an impact on the music. He came up with great ideas. He introduced some new melodies. He also did on a lot of songs some great arrangement ideas. He brought in some ideas, and particularly "What About Us." There's a lot of Paul Sabu in this song, definitely.
One of the things too that I find really cool is the fact that you do have the sitar and the mandolin and the cello. Like, you are trying to bring in those extra instruments. I mean, right off the bat, I mean, No More has a very Middle Eastern flavor to it. So, like, you know, what was the impetus behind that?
Honestly, I wish I could tell you something really cool or intellectual, but the truth is, we're like, dude, that sounds cool. Let's do it. It's really like it really is like that. I mean, how should I say it? I mean, obviously, it's the album is, I consider it like a love letter to the music I grew up with, which is 80s AOR and rock music. But at the same time, I mean, it doesn't make much sense to make an album that sounds like, I don't know, The Strange Ways or you know, like really very, I'm missing the word, you know, like what do you expect somehow or like from that era, because it has been done and it has been done fantastically. So you have to come up with some new stuff. And we just tried different things, and in the end, like I said, it's you try something and it sounds cool, and then you're like, cool, let's do that.
You know, we are also from grow up listening to the music of the 80s. I think we're about the same age as you, so I mean, our favorite bands may have been your favorite bands. What were your favorite bands in the 80s?
I love Def Leppard. Well, I'm gonna get into the other stuff later, but Def Leppard is it's the band that brings, like, I can listen to a lot of old stuff and I enjoy it and it's great, but Def Leppard somehow takes me back in that time. It's like it has the most emotional impact on me. I don't know what it is. I can't put my finger exactly on it. I guess it's the whole combination of the songwriting. I think Phil Collins' guitars have a lot to do with it. There's this beautiful, even back then, this kind of, if you listen to the track Hysteria, there's a beautiful nostalgia in it, right? But it's not like, it's not depressing, like, oh, those were the times, you know? It's, it just takes you back in a really, really nice way. Well, other bands I like, Kiss, Whitesnake, yeah, especially those bands that were all those bands that I mentioned defined themselves mainly through great songwriting, right? I mean, not that other bands didn't have great songs, but especially those bands, I mean, like Kiss, I mean, they have like 30 or 40 songs that are smash hits, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Kiss is absolutely, I mean, those are our favorite bands as well. So, I mean, it's really easy to understand and find common ground. But so one of the things I'm interested in is, like, when you're choosing a drum kit, like, and especially from the variety of things that you do, like, how do you just use, like, one drum kit? Do you kind of go through multiple, you know, configurations of it?
I have a few cases I have been booked as a studio drummer. And in those situations, there was a drum set there. They had it, they had their stuff, they had it mic'd up already, and I was just coming in to play the drums. When everything else, I'm using my drum set. And it's a Tama Star Classic set, which I bought in 1995. And the funny thing is, when I bought it, I was disappointed for a few years. It didn't sound like the way I hoped it would. And I know this sounds ridiculous, but I don't know if it's because I got older and maybe more experienced in tuning drums right, or if the wood really changes or an instrument changes its character over time. Maybe both of it. But by now, I love my drum set. It sounds fantastic. It sounds really great. And I hope this doesn't get too nerdy, but like the bass drum, for example, it's a great, like, nowadays, if you buy a drum set, if you buy a rock set, you know, the bass drum's like this pure thunder cannon, but it doesn't have a tone to it. But if you buy a jazz kit, you know, you have like a singing tone, but it doesn't have punch. And that bass drum, the bass drum of my drum set it's kind of in the middle there. You know, it's like it has great punch. It really rocks, for the lack of a better term. But it also sings it. You could do some Motown or even fusion stuff with it. And I know it so well. I can tune it very fast if I go into a studio. It doesn't take me a whole lot of time to get a good sound out of it. And the configuration hardly changes. It's pretty straight ahead, you know. Pick, snare, three toms and cymbals, and off we go.
How hard is it then to go into a studio, like into that studio where it's somebody else's drum kit and you're now forced to sit down and play that?
It's inspirational. There's, I don't know if you have a new sound, always is kind of exciting, at least for a while. And I totally enjoy it. It even happened to me that I've been in an album production a few years ago, and you know, the drum set was mic'd and the room sounded fantastic and all the rest of it. And in the evening, I had a rehearsal with another band. And I went into that rehearsal room, which really was like a hole. And there's this crappy junkyard set with this almost broken old fart Remo, what was those pinstripe drum heads on it. And you play the set and say, oh man, it sounds great. I should use it. Because in this moment, it sounds new. It sounds fresh. It kind of gets you out of your routine somehow. And it's fun. It's just fun. So it was just positive experiences being on another instrument.
So, of course, Paul has been in the industry for, you know, so many years. Did you learn anything new from him?
Absolutely, yeah. Especially the arranging part, the arranging ideas he brought in. And I mean, of course, we talked some tech stuff. It's like, hey, dude, what preamp did you use, or what microphone did you use, and what did you use, a compressor or an EQ already? So yeah, I learned something in terms of recording, actually, because the voice sounded great, the vocal tracks, and especially in terms of arranging. Absolutely, yeah.
Now, how long, I guess when it comes to like drum production and then eventually music production, like how do you know that you've kind of gotten it right for you?
I can't exactly point my finger on it, but it's like you feel it very early on. So that's the good thing. I never run into a situation where I spent like days or wasted studio time and then like, oh shit, this is not happening. It's like I don't know if you guys play pool. I do sometimes. I'm not a professional, but you know, but it's something like this. Like you feel it when before your cue hits the ball, you already know if you screwed up or if you're gonna putt that one. And it's a little bit like this with music production. It's like if something's off, usually you know it really early on.
How long do you, like in a day for you, like how much do you play the drums? How much do you like produce? How much do you kind of like do the other variety of jobs that you have?
I wish I could tell you I'm playing 6 hours the drums and then I work an hour in the computer or so, but I turn on my computer at, I don't know, 9 in the morning and turn it off at 8 at night. It's mostly working in the studio, so to speak. Like drumming is not a great part. It became a hobby if you want, but I mean I do practice, but it's not, I'm not in a situation right now where I would expand my horizon or learn new stuff. I'm just making sure I'm not getting rusty or, you know, getting out of shape. But it's a great thing too, you know. It's like it sounds weird, but I think I'm a better drummer these days than I've been at the times where I was sitting 6 hours, 7 hours in a practice lab. Because you kind of learn to let go, and I don't know, you approach the drums with a different mindset, with a fresh mindset. And when you're a musician and you pay your rent and you fill your fridge with playing your instrument, it gets easy to, or it happens easily that you kind of lose your drive or your enthusiasm. You know, it becomes a job. And backing off from that a little helped me, I guess. I mean, I feel I feel way more inspired playing drums these days than I did in the past.
How important is it to keep your body in shape, to keep in good shape when you're a drummer?
It is very important. It's not, I would say it's not as crucial as, say, a trumpet player. You know, like if you're a professional trumpet player and you don't play a few weeks, you're in serious, serious trouble. Drumming is a little bit more forgiving, I would say, but I mean, you have to stay in shape, definitely. But I'm taking good care of my body. I'm doing sports, and that's also an important part, and helps with the drumming, actually.
How did your, I guess, life and career change, especially like once the pandemic started and we kind of wound up, you know, everything suddenly like got locked in? Like, how did that impact you?
Hardly. I was like, man, I guess I did some right decisions in the past, because I'm not, like I said, I'm not playing live a whole lot. I'm not depending on generating income being on stage. Rather, I work in the studio. It affects me. My royalty checks are smaller than they used to be. There's less production of be it trailer or commercials or, you know, television content. On the other hand, since that is the situation, there's a lot of stuff repeating, which also benefits me, because I guess I've been in the right place at the right time a few times, and I have a lot of stuff running on television, and it generates a comfortable income. And so far, I'm really lucky, really lucky.
Well, that's fantastic. Before we go, I do want to go back to Corporate Control again. Like, I want to talk about just the cover. Like, it's a really cool cover, and also even just the band name. So how did like the band name come about, and then how did the cover come about?
The band name also was like, so I thought of it like as a tribute to the bands in the 80s, metal bands, rock bands. You know, rock and metal has hardly been political, you know? Like, I mean, there may be some hints or some, well, Megadeth may be political, but not in a way that it is today, you know, like where everything's political. You get an agenda pressed in your face when you watch TV series, or you can hardly escape it. And I kind of miss the times where it's just about good fun, you know? And all those rock bands, they had, you know, you would pick a badass name, you know, I don't know, like Nuclear Assault, right? But you wouldn't be like deadly serious about it or political about it. It was just, you know, having a good time, taking yourself not too seriously and have fun. And I thought, well, Corporate Control kind of sounds evil, probably is. And it had a nice groove to it when you say the name, right? And the cover also, it was like, yeah, let's go totally cliche. You know, what would you put on a rock record? Yeah, a skull, of course. And so we started developing some ideas, and the graphic guy came up with this idea of having the skull embedded in the, I don't know if it's the Milky Way, you know, like stars in the universe. It's like, man, it looks really cool, and off we went.
Definitely has that right feel, that right fit, and so that's one of the reasons that I like it, because, you know, skulls are definitely cool, and metal.
Yeah, and you know, it's not that serious. It's like, I miss that. I really miss that these days. Everything you watch, you hear a lot of, especially on movies and television or video games, it's so political, and I'm so tired of it, you know? Let's have some fun.
Besides corporate control, then, what are some of the your favorite things that you've done?
Well, corporate control definitely is the favorite thing I've done. Really is. Another favorite thing, it wasn't such a big deal in terms of music. I learned from my publisher that a snippet of my music had been used in a TV show by, I'm probably pronouncing the name wrong, Dominic Monaghan.
Oh, yeah, Dominic Monaghan, yeah.
And I'm a huge fan of Lost, the TV series, you know. And he's playing Charlie, the fictional rock star, right? And when I learned that, it's like, man, this is so cool. I'm kind of around a few corners. I'm connected to that Lost universe. That is so cool. I really loved it.
That's awesome. Yeah, I mean, those kind of moments must be really neat. And just the kind of doors that I guess you have the chance to open and see your music appear in must be a lot of fun for sure.
Yeah, I'm curious what video games, you know, if there's any video games we might know that you've been in, if your music is being in.
My music is in, well, EA. EA Sports used it on on a different occasions, but it's in that they have a UFC fighting game, and there's some of my music is in that game.
Okay, I'll go play that game right now. As soon as we're done.
Right on.
I happen to have it.
That is awesome. Well, Marcus, I do really appreciate you coming on the show and taking the time up to spend with us. It's been great talking to you about it. So I want to give you the chance to tell everybody where they can find Corporate Control and how to keep up with you.
Well, you'll find Corporate Control on Amazon, pretty much every retailer. We're on Spotify, iTunes, and the whole rest of it. Or you could go check out the website Paris Records. That's our label. And they have overseas shipping. You could order the CD just there if in case the CD is not available in your country.
Well, I definitely urge everybody to go out and listen to it because I think it's an awesome rock and roll album and tons of fun. So, and of course... You're all great.
I just want to mention, you know, for me, we interview 2 to 3 people a week, usually, you know, and I like a lot of the music, but as soon as I'm done that album and that interview, I move on. That won't be the case with Corporate Control. This is going to be part of my regular playlist to listen to because the album is so good. And you know, thank you very much for doing it and for joining us. You come to Calgary again, we'll take you to the Chuck Wagon races.
It sounds like a deal.
Awesome. Well, thanks a lot, Marcus.
On the podcast.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. It's been great. Marcus, thank you so much and all the best in the future. Look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
Thanks. You too. Bye now.
A million miles away from you is too long. I never took the chance to say that I love you. Images and words come back to me so strong. Everything I do, I would do. Let you slip away, but that was then. If only I could turn back time to start again. Well, I'd be running in the night with you. Anything I do, I would do. Whatever it takes. Yeah. do. In a dream, you finally let me.